Welcome to the Israel Conversation by the Masa Leadership and Impact Center. We are informally debating issues that concern Zionists about life, culture, and politics in Israel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Benji Davis. Welcome, everyone, to this great podcast episode where I have two wonderful guests here. One is Michael Unterberg. How are you, Michael?
All right. How you doing, Benji?
Doing great. Doing wonderful. Stupendous. Matthew Littman is here as well. Hello, Matthew.
Good morning, Benji.
It's not the morning, but how are you doing?
Also, listeners aren't listening in the morning.
But it is 11:27.
It depends on how you define morning.
Before noon.
Dependent on one's definition. Anyway.
I don't think I could get breakfast in an IHOP.
For how long I've already been awake today, it really feels like it's evening. But anyway,
Hashtag
welcome.
Father of three small children.
Yes. So what we're talking about today is one of the great institutions of our liberal international order post-World War II, which starts with a united and ends in a nations, the United Nations. And it has become very relevant recently in terms of Israel standing, the U.S.-Israel relationship, as the United States recently abstained from a Security Council resolution calling for an end to the war in Gaza. And there's been quite a ruckus here in Israel that how much this is affecting Israel's standing, its ability to fight its war and advance its interests in the international arena, and perhaps with really bad ramifications for the U.S.-Israel relationship. So what we're going to do is debate this. And we have two sides that we'll be debating, Michael and Matthew, on one saying, well, actually, this is really important, and here's why. And the other taking the Ben-Gurion approach, which is shmoom. So who's going first?
I believe I have that privilege.
Well, let me pass the baton on to you, Matthew.
Is it a privilege or a poison chalice? I'm not sure, but it's one of the two. Okay, so I think what's firstly, personally, I would like to point out, for those of you who've been listening to this podcast for a while, or even if you're just tuning in now, you may notice I do not have an American accent. I am not American. I am not an American citizen. Some of my favorite wives and children are American citizens. I've lived in the United States. I've worked in the United States. But I am currently, myself, not American.
Is Matt coming out as a polygamist?
And that has multiple wives.
It's a line I use always with my students when ask me, are you American? But
you have actually lived in America more recently than the two Americans here.
I left America in 2011.
Oh.
I left in 2012.
2009.
All right. So... But I still think in that context, it's important to point that out because I don't have that sort of upbringing and you can call it baggage if you want.
Episode over, Matt concedes. That's great. I win by default.
British thing to do.
Of the American. Listen, I'll go make you a cup of tea. Everything will be fine. Unless you throw it into a harbor. But the point being that I don't have that sort of background of baggage of, oh, the American-Israel relationship is unshakable and blah, 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 and all that sort of thing. So I do think it's important to point that out. In terms of the events in the United Nations earlier this week, again, we're recording this the end of March, but the events in the United Nations when a motion was brought to the United Nations Security Council that was calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza till the end of Ramadan, and also almost like as a side point, calling for the release of the hostages, under which there was no condition. One was not made conditional on the other. All the emphasis, all the onus was placed on Israel. And of course, Israel is a member of the United Nations and a signatory to the United Nations Charter, whereas Hamas is not. So the analogy I gave to my students the other day was, it's a bit like when, and this is when I was teaching in Aardvark, and I said to them, if you say to like a Young Judea Year Course participant, if you don't keep the rules of Aardvark, you're not allowed to come on the Aardvark teal. Well, that's ridiculous because they're not on Aardvark anyway, so they're not coming. So how it actually affects Hamas is questionable. How it affects the Israel-United States relationship, however, I think is important because the United States basically took away their diplomatic coverage, their diplomatic umbrella, as it's being referred to, for Israel, and left Israel with a sense of isolation and left Israel with a sense of, oh, shoot, even America is ditching us. Now, you might say, okay, well, in practical terms, does that have any issues? Even if practically you may say it doesn't have that much significance, there is a feeling of morale, right? A feeling of, well, somebody understands us, somebody has our back. To lose that is significant. Whether you want to argue practical terms, it doesn't have, or material terms, or not, or anything like that, isn't significant. The fact that a lot of Israelis, myself included, thought, whoa, we just got chucked under the bus here. That's significant, especially for a country that's experienced trauma, continuing to experience trauma, and fighting a war. The fact that people feel that we're being abandoned by what was supposedly our closest ally is significant. Then if you want to move to the practical considerations, at the moment, does it make a big difference practically? No. Could it be, and again, we've talked before on this podcast about none of us are prophets, but could it be potentially the beginning of a snowball? Very much so. Because if you're going to say, listen, at this point, America's taken away their diplomatic umbrella for Israel, and people say, okay, now that relationship isn't quite as ironclad as we thought it was. Okay, now America's willing to give into a little bit of pressure here, a bit of pressure there. And of course, in the context of it's a presidential campaign, and yes, President Biden has to look at that and see where his support is coming from and where his opponent, Donald Trump, is going to get his support from. Of course, it's all of course we have to see it in that context. But if that context leads President Biden or other senior members of the administration to, firstly, they started by chiding Israel. Then they started saying, listen, you've got to change things. Then they said, okay, we're taking away the diplomatic coverage. It steps, and each step eventually may lead to the ultimate step. Okay, we're not providing you with some of the weapons that you want. We're not providing you with some of the ammunition that you need for those weapons. And so I do think it makes a big difference. I do, whether it's on a morale level or the beginning of a practical level, I do think it makes a difference. And I know people are going to say, oh, it's happened in the past. Every president has had their spat with Israel, and every president, the relationship has recovered. Okay, but not every president has had Prime Minister Netanyahu sitting in the prime ministerial seat in Israel. And yes, it may be that in a few years' time, we may not have him either, but relationships can be destroyed very quickly, and it takes a long time to regain trust. And if Israel sees that the United States cares less about them than they thought, and of course, the United States' other supposed allies sees that America's willing to throw Israel under the bus, it changes a lot in the dynamics in political terms.
Michael?
I actually don't think it changes anything in the dynamics. I think this is the dynamic. It's the dynamic of allies. When you describe a relationship, when I have a relationship, whether it's friendship or familial, there's love and human connection. Allied nations, you know, the Truman administration, which recognized the state of Israel, I don't know anybody alive from that government in either government, America or Israel. Israel and America are allies, not because there's a connection that's personal. That will affect diplomacy. But Israel and America are allies for the reason that nations are allies. They have overlapping interests. And so I do want to separate between the level of diplomacy and communication and the level of practicality. On the level of diplomacy, I would argue that it is the norm in UN politics that America will veto any bill in the Security Council. The Security Council, made after World War II, it has 10 rotating chairs, 5 permanent chairs, the victors of World War II. Why that's relevant in 2024, I would argue, makes no sense that these are the 5 permanent seats. America, UK, Russia, China, and France. Why those are the 5 permanent seats? Each one with total veto power. If any one of them vetoes a resolution, the resolution's dead. Which shows you how sensible the UN as a structural organization is. That makes no sense. It's just that's what they did after because they won World War II. It makes no sense. And so America uses that veto power on behalf of Israel. It's a very comfortable part of the alliance, as Matthew's describing. For America to abstain on that vote is America, forgive me, giving the middle finger to the Israeli government. That's what it's intended to do. All the American politicians saying, what? What's the big deal? There's no difference. But it's the same as our previous policy. It's the same. It's not binding. There's nothing in the resolution that's going to change anything. That's also part of diplomacy, to be passive aggressive and say, when I give the middle finger, I didn't give you the middle finger. The Israelis in return, the Netanyahu administration, gave the middle finger back to America, right? They canceled a major meeting, which now, of course, Bibi's trying to reinstitute because it's practically very important and useful for both sides. So once the symbolism of the middle finger was there, he also blamed this resolution for Hamas refusing a hostage deal, even though Hamas had refused the hostage deal before the resolution was made. But that was his way of giving America back the middle finger. Bibi is doing it. Now, there are two explanations for why that middle finger happened on both ends. Either Bibi and Biden have finally come to loggerheads and they're getting so angry at each other that that anger is influencing their decisions and those two administrations are clashing in an actual fight. Or Bibi and Biden, who know each other for what? 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
They have a close relationship, working relationship. I don't think either of them likes the other one. They certainly don't agree on a lot of things. They've always known how to work together. I don't think they're children that suddenly let their emotions overwhelm them. I think if I employ Occam's razor, there's a much simpler explanation. Biden is bleeding in Michigan, and he knows he needs it to get the electoral votes to win in November. He's bleeding in Michigan largely because a large Arab population say they won't vote for him because of how he's handling Gaza. Him getting into a fight with Bibi is very good for him electorally. If he can do it without any actual consequences, politically, it's a smart move. Maybe offensive to Israelis. It is supposed to be offensive to Israelis to work. That's what it is. Bibi is getting into, is raising his profile and his base. Look at me. I don't give in to American pressure. I have a backbone. I'm one of these Israelis who takes care of the home front first. And that is very popular with Israelis. Both of them are doing internal politics. I agree with you, Matt, that at the level of morale, it leaves many Israelis feeling alone in the world, right? Eretz Nehederet, the Israeli comedy show, did the We Are Without the World spoof. Like, you know, we feel, yeah, okay, it's a bad feeling for a second. But I also think that the running around screaming, like, oh my gosh, how could they have done this? How did they all completely forget October 7th? I don't know what people are talking about. And I think that while it is a morale damager, America needs Israel to destroy Hamas. Israel needs American weapons and ammunition to destroy Hamas, beginning, middle, end. The allies' motives are the same. At the practical level, let me read to you this non-binding resolution that America abstained from. If you know how UN resolutions are written, there's always these gerunds, these verbs at the beginning that announced the background of why they're guided by, recalling all, reiterating, expressing deep concern, acknowledging, blah, blah, blah. And then it gets to the part that we're interested in. What are the demands? Non-binding. Security Council is the only branch of the United Nations that has the ability to make binding resolutions that nations must comply with. This one's not. This one's saying this is just what we think should happen as a Security Council. And here's the words. Number one. The Security Council demands an immediate ceasefire for the month of Ramadan, respected by all parties, leading to a lasting, sustainable ceasefire, and also demands the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages, as well as ensuring humanitarian access to address their medical and other humanitarian needs, meaning the hostages, and further demands that the parties comply with their obligations under international law in relation to all persons they detain. That's number one. Number two, emphasizes the urgent need to expand the flow of humanitarian assistance to and reinforce the protection of civilians in the entire Gaza Strip, and reiterates its demand for the lifting of all barriers to the provision of humanitarian assistance at scale, in line with internal humanitarian law, as well as resolutions 2712 and 2720. Number three, we decide to remain actively seized of the matter. That's the demands. That's the text. I would argue that number one is exclusively aimed at Hamas. Israel is not engaged in any serious military action since the beginning of Ramadan. By the way, Ramadan's what, a week and a half left? Is 2 weeks when they pass the resolution? We don't want you to start any military things in the next 2 weeks. Was Israel planning on starting anything in the next 2 weeks? Is it going to hurt to wait 2 weeks? I don't know. We want that ceasefire to last. Great, great. Hamas fighters are attacking Israeli soldiers from Shifa Hospital as we speak and have since the resolution, before the resolution. So Hamas is not doing this. Okay. And you said it barely mentions the hostages. Number one is address to Hamas, and its main point is you have to release the hostages. If you're contradictorily, if you're holding them, you have to make sure they get humanitarian and medical aid. And three, you have to obey the law of what it means to hold somebody. You have to be better, Hamas. Now, I agree with you, Hamas isn't going to listen. But why would Israel have a problem with it? Israel has a problem with number two, which says that humanitarian aid has to be improved. And I read to you the whole language. I wasn't excerpting from the demand. Now, that's the UN's job. That's the international community's job. They want to demand. There's a million Palestinians living in tents, half the population of Gaza. The other half is in Rafah right now, waiting for the Israeli invasion. The million that are out are living in tents. I understand. I'm a little bit cynical also about they're on the verge of starvation. You can't be on the verge for 3 months. But and if I was a parent of one of the, you know, one of these families and my kids are hungry, I'm not saying there's going to be starvation, but they're in a very dangerous situation. I understand the international community calling out to improve that. As an Israeli, you can be in the debate about how Israel should process that or not. On a practical level, there's nothing in this resolution that's a problem. And so America abstaining from it, which, again, is a middle finger because it didn't veto, it abstained, which diplomatically sends a message, things are bad, we're in a fight, but it clearly has no practical ramifications. And even if it did in that wording, and it does not, it's non-binding. So there'll be no consequence if Israel doesn't listen to a word of it, and Israel, of course, is already listening to all of it. So I understand that people who don't process at the level of depth, their morale falls. I don't understand why pundits and analysts are freaking out in Israel. I honestly don't understand. Other than an emotional, how could they do this to us in the middle of a war? Don't they understand? We're all in post-traumatic stress. I think it's good self-care to not catastrophize, to put this into context. I have read in history books about big fights that administrations have had in the Eisenhower administration, in the Johnson administration, and in the Nixon administration. I can recall in real time, you're saying people will say this, I will say this. I remember fights with the Carter administration, the Reagan administration, the H.W. Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the W. Bush administration, the Obama administration, and the Trump administration fighting. And you say those weren't all Netanyahu? Frankly, most of them were with Netanyahu. That's what you do for politics. Sometimes there's something really underlying it, and sometimes there isn't. But it doesn't matter because as long as American interests and Israeli interests overlap, America and Israel will be allies. And so it does hurt morale. But that's part of the game. That's part of Israeli screaming is part of what Biden is using for his politics. Is that dispiriting and offensive and painful to us? Sure, that's how the game is played. It's theater. And so I refuse to play along with the theater because I don't think it's good for me, for my self-care and my morale. And so I protect my morale by understanding. You're saying it could lead to. Anything could lead to. Any problem can get better, can stay the same, or get worse. Almost every time we've ever had one of these spats over nothing, it's ended up being nothing. Could it lead to? Yeah. But I'm not going to panic over it could. That's what I call, and I think what cognitive behavioral therapy calls, catastrophizing. Here's the worst possible outcome, and I'm going to function on that. Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? If that happens, if America stops sending arms to Israel, okay, then I'll be upset because there's a practical difference. But as long as it's in the realm of verbiage and feelings and diplomacy where both sides are being passive-aggressive, that's politics. I understand that that's the game and that's the theater. Do what you got to do. We're okay. That's my argument.
So essentially, Michael, you're umshmoom?
No.
You're not umshmoom?
I don't think that's debatable, umshmoom. The famous Ben-Gurion quote that I don't really care what the UN says because they're not relevant is objectively a truth at this point. I think the world knows it. I think the fact that you have, you know, and we as Zionists very often complain about UNRWA perpetuating the conflict by teaching Palestinians that the only way they can have a sustainable future is by destroying a member nation of the UN. The Human Rights Council, which in the UN, which doesn't condemn Israel more than any other country every year. It condemns Israel more than all other countries combined every year. And in a world with North Korea and Iran and Russia and Saudi Arabia, it's a dysfunctional institution. It's dedicated in principle to the ideologies of freedom, human rights, democracy. And like 60% of the world's inhabitants live in countries that don't believe in freedom, human rights, democracy, and liberty. So they are co-opting this organization to do all sorts of crazy, nonsensical things. And so it's an organization that basically, for the most part, certainly in its political demands and proclamations, has no impact. So Shmoom, I don't even think I need to debate. What I'm saying is, more than Shmoom, this fight between the Netanyahu administration and the Biden administration is, put it in your rearview mirror, I don't care.
And Matthew, what's your response to the more macro argument, as well as the micro, if you'd like?
Well, I think to come
well,
back,
it's Mike making the argument, so I guess it's micro.
Maybe you should take a boat.
Sure.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And row it.
How many of our listeners will even get that reference?
I think you're underplaying and discounting the effect that the domestic politics has on the actions internationally, because you mentioned it, but in terms of, yes, having to win votes for both sides, both for Prime Minister Netanyahu and for President Biden, and playing to their bases and saying it's just theater, and it may be, and I hope you're right. I don't know, because the question is, once you start opening that and you start doing the giving those middle fingers, if you give somebody the middle finger often enough, then they're going to get really pissed off and punch you on the nose. And if they punch you on the nose, you're going to punch them back on the nose. And suddenly what was meant to be theater and drama has descended into actual real action. Well, yes, I know you're going to tell me I'm catastrophizing or whatever the word was. Maybe, but that doesn't mean that it's not real, right? Just because I'm scared of something doesn't mean it's not a real concern. And again, I think that the world that we're living in is different to the worlds when all these, right? We joked about it before, context matters, but context really does matter. And in terms of the world we're living in and saying that America's interests are strongly aligned with Israel's, yes, I think that that has also changed geopolitically and on the international stage. I think that's changing. And I also think that I don't think it's in the rearview mirror. I just don't.
All right. I think that's exactly what catastrophizing means, is that it is an unfounded concern. I think when you're describing two people, if they get into a fender bender and they get out of their cars and they start giving each other in the middle finger, that might be a fist fight. I think that's the wrong analogy. I think it's a better analogy might be two people in a business partnership. And if they get mad and have a fight, but if they dissolve their business relationship, they'll both lose millions of dollars. They'll get past the middle finger. In other words, it's not simply an issue of, geopolitics doesn't revolve around feelings to that extent. Self-interest also kicks in. And America doesn't want to self-destruct and Israel doesn't want to self-destruct. An abandoned Israel, a failed Israel, is a disaster for American policy in the Middle East. And America has a lot of trouble managing its relationships in the Middle East. It's a disaster for the free world. It's a disaster for economics of the world. Israel's a crucial country. It's the regional superpower of the Middle East, militarily, economically, culturally.
But why is it militarily? Because of the vast amount of aid that America gives it. So if America decides to channel it somewhere else,
where's it going to channel it?
There are options.
I'd like to hear some.
The UAE, Saudi Arabia.
The UAE. The UAE can post an army as big as Israel?
It cannot currently. But with the right support from America.
It doesn't have the population. It doesn't have the numbers. Saudi Arabia also. They simply can't, and they cannot pass a democratic army. Democracies don't fight wars against other democracies. That's a rule of history. It just doesn't. Democracies don't lose wars against non-democracies. A democratic citizen army cannot be equaled by the UAE or Saudi Arabia, no matter what they do. Otherwise, they would. There's this historical problem, okay, that you have armies that are unbeatable. Other nations say, well, let's learn how to do it. You had this problem of multiple nations. Rome had this problem. The Greeks had this problem. These steppe warriors, they come in from the plains. They've been riding horses since they're kids. They can shoot 3 hours at a time from a moving horse. And the standing armies don't know how to deal with them. So they start training a cavalry to deal with them. Guess what? If your cavalry didn't grow up on the plains riding on horses, you cannot equal them. A democratic citizen army, you cannot build an equal army in the Arab world. You can't. It's just, if you know anything about the history of warfare, Saudi Arabia cannot create an Israeli army. By the way, Go back in history. The last time an Arab nation state sent its army to invade Israel was 1973. The only Arab population big enough to fight Israel was Egypt. And in 1973, they said, we cannot militarily beat Israel. We cannot build that army. And so Anwar Sadat, the orchestrator of the Yom Kippur invasion, said, I guess we have to make peace with Israel because we, the biggest, most powerful Arab nation on earth, cannot institutionally, constitutionally, build an army that can fight Israel. We can't fight a citizen democratic army. And you can go to John Keegan and all these military historians why that is. There's nothing like it. And the fact that Israel is an open Western democracy means America has an ally that it can talk to and communicate with and fight with in a way that it can't with any other country in the Middle East. And it desperately needs intelligence. It desperately needs guidance. It definitely needs insight. It definitely needs military preparation. It needs a million things from Israel. And that's just at that level, putting aside the economic.
I think the mutual interest isn't.
We're going to give the last word to Matthew for.
I think the mutual interest isn't in the way that you're describing anymore.
Right.
And that's partly because of the politics in terms of the military. Listen, also, the last 50 years, warfare has changed. Weapon capabilities have changed, all those sorts of things. So
you have an example of a non-democracy beating a democracy in war or standing up to even temporarily?
Not yet. But again, things change. And I know you think I'm being a doomsayer, but I think eventually the politics behind all of these things and the way that the world perceives Israel and the way the United States perceives Israel has changed.
Here's where I agree with you. If everything was different, we would be in trouble. I agree with you.
But it has changed.
And you're saying it could be totally different.
And it will continue to change. And that's why I think this, and I think this middle finger is going to escalate. It's going to escalate. And we don't have enough adults in the room who are intervening to say, okay, let's calm this down. Let's take a step back. Let's see what those mutual interests are. Instead of chucking each other under the bus constantly, let's see what we can do to calm down the situation and continue to work towards a shared mutual interest, because at the moment, I think things are escalating.
I'm opening up my Google Calendar right now to March 2025. Today's the 28th. I'm putting an appointment that says, ask Matt if he still thinks so.
Excellent.
And I will bring it, God willing, I will bring it up to you next year, and we'll see who thinks, perception was more accurate.
We tend to book our sessions with Ben a few weeks in advance, but Ben, can you put that in your calendar too? We'll be back.
All right, listeners. So we're going to have a sequel of this episode.
I don't know if it'll be an episode.
Have we done that before?
March 2025. Shmoom, or does the UN really matter? With Matthew, Michael, Ben, and myself. And I look forward to that. This has been quite the debate, actually, with a really nice back and forth. Thank you. Thank you for being with us. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Benji.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Benji.
Ben, the producer, always a pleasure. Peace be upon you. And on that note, I will imitate the great Rabbi Michael Unterberg and say bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Israel Conversation by the Masah Leadership and Impact Center. In everything we do, we hope to connect our fellows to Israel as home, that our Masah fellows will feel at home in Israel and understand more about Israel in all of its diversity. We connect our fellows to Jewish peoplehood, to feel an affinity for Judaism and a sense of belonging to the Jewish people, and the connection is active and meaningful in their lives. And finally, personal development. And in the case of this podcast, our goal is that you'll be able to use the tools and learning for reflection and future development in conversations about Israel and Judaism. If this episode is meaningful to you, please subscribe and share with somebody that you think it will be meaningful to.